You're listening to a podcast from the RSA. You can find out more about RSA events and projects and how to get involved with the fellowship by visiting our website, thersa.org.
So good evening, everyone. I'm Matthew Taylor. I'm Chief Executive of the RSA. It's my great pleasure to welcome you all here this evening. I'm delighted to introduce this evening's event, which marks the publication of an RSA review on localism. There we are. People-shaped localism. So we're exploring particular nature of the localist project, where it now stands, where it might go in the future. The paper draws on learning from a three-year partnership with Wiltshire Council and argues that localism has shown most promise where it has enabled local people and their council to collaborate. Sometimes localism is presented as a kind of way of pulling power away from local authorities. We found that it's where local authorities and communities collaborate that localism works best. That collaborative culture is the essential building block of a sustainable public service settlement, enabling services co-designed and co-delivered with resilient communities. Before I introduce you to our expert panel of speakers, I thought I might indulge a bit of recollection. I am reminiscing. I think I might have been in the office with David Miliband when he was local government minister, when he came up with the phrase double devolution. I'm just reflecting, really, how modest Labour's ambitions were under that phrase double devolution in comparison to what has happened since. So if you think of the Localism Act and now, of course, of structural devolution emanating from the Treasury in particular, big devolution as we call it in our report, double devolution has really taken place on a big scale. And I think in many ways it would be churlish to complain at that scale of reform, and indeed the RSA led the call for big devolution. But as we, I think, argue in the report, there are interesting questions open up about what is the relationship between these two processes. Because, of course, structural devolution is, broadly speaking, pulling power up to higher local levels, whereas, of course, localism is supposed to be about drawing power down to the lowest level. So interesting conversations about how those two things work together. I don't think we want to argue in our report. We don't argue in our report for neatness. But I think a certain amount of clarity would be helpful. Legibility, a system at least that people could explain and understand slightly more than one that we've got at the moment. But maybe that's just a transitional phase. Anyway, those are some of the points that are, appear in our report, which I just read again this afternoon. Actually, it's rather readable. So I'd like to say that to its author, Paul. It's not always true of RSA reports that they're readable, but it is now. It's a very readable report. So well done on that, and I think you can download it from our website. So, who have we got to speak to us tonight? Well, I'm supposed to be introducing first Katie Goetz, who's Chief Executive of the Electoral Reform Society, but she's not actually here, but she is going to be here. So she'll be speaking last. We're going to be hearing from Colin Kay, who's an education and community consultant, David Boyle, Director at the New Weather Institute, and Jackie McKinley, Executive Director at the Centre for Public Scrutiny. Before we start our presentations and discussion, though, I'd like to invite Steve Milton to the platform. Steve is Head of Community Governance at Wiltshire Council, and he's here this evening to say a few words about the learning partnership which has underlain our work and to talk about the continuing ambitions for localism in Wiltshire. And without Wiltshire's support, none of this work would be taking place, including this event this evening. So please welcome Steve Milton.
Thank you very much for that. I'm not used to getting a round of applause when taking a stage. First, I'd like to thank Paul and Matthew and Jocelyn and the team here at the RSA for the great work they've done in Wiltshire over the last 3 years. They provided us with insights, creativity, new ideas, perspectives that some people like me, beleaguered practitioners, often struggle to find time for. So thanks for that, Paul. The outcome of the project, I think, is a significant moment, and I hope it will contribute to a national discussion about localism and devolution. And I think it does actually ask us the question and does push us, really, to reimagine the relationship between the civic and the public realm, and I'm thankful for that. I mean, I work in a large local authority, and like everyone else in the public sector, we're challenged by financial pressures, budget cuts, and increasingly, I think, what we do is done within the context of cost benefits and impact assessment, And that tends to disincentivise innovation. You know, we need certainty, don't we? And it can be a barrier to creativity. I mean, the outcomes of our engagement increasingly are predefined. And it does squeeze out room for the qualitative. You know, we need the facts, don't we? So working with communities in that sort of space, I think, is not easy. And localism is becoming a hard sell. But we've seen in Wiltshire that localism does work. I mean, communities are crammed with skills, gifts, enthusiasms, creativity. And that's really is the lifeblood of our communities. And we've seen that actually by devolving powers and resources to communities, the localism can work. We have an empowerment fund which we devolve to communities. And for every pound that's invested from that fund, the community bring £4 to the table. So, I mean, at a time of austerity, that's quite a compelling argument for increased devolution. To finish, government is obviously no longer the sole domain of civic institutions. It's fragmented, it's hollowed out, it's increasingly complex. And I think if we're going to make a difference about things like obesity, about things like dementia and delayed discharges from hospital, we're going to need to develop new collaborative approaches. We need to seek out and find creative spaces for dialogue. And we need to make the relationship between the state we need to renew the relationship between the state and the people it serves. So, I mean, welcome this evening, and I hope you enjoy the rest of the evening. Thank you.
Thank you, Steve.
Okay, Colin, you're on first.
Okay, good evening. I'm going to say a little bit about a project called Common Knowledge, which grew out of the work that the RSA did with Wiltshire. Wiltshire was seeking to re-engineer its leisure and health and community facilities. And to do that, it set up in each of its 19 community areas what it called community operation boards. And their job was to carry out consultation, to establish the needs of their community, and then to plan the new provision around those specific needs. Community engagement was a key part of their work, not only engaging with local people, but with the service providers, both public and third sector, who are going to deliver those activities within the new provision, and not least by engaging with the members of those boards itself, because this is a 3 to 5 to 7, I've been involved since 2012, year project. And actually you need to engage those volunteers and maintain their commitment and enthusiasm over a long period of time. Being a volunteer community leader, though, can be both lonely and challenging. It's not easy to find the time and space to stand back and reflect on what you're doing. And if the people that you're working with are actually part of the challenge you face, it can be difficult to find other people outside your context to share your concerns with and get advice. Wiltshire's a large county, and it can also feel quite geographically isolated as well. The aim of the Common Knowledge Project was to produce something to provide support, particularly around community engagement, initially aimed at those community operation boards. Something that not would just be a toolkit or a list of best practice, but something that would be more dynamic, challenging groups to reflect, to share experiences, to learn, but to feel they were supported. The group was set up by drawing on different campuses at different stages of development, and from the start there was a very clear set of values. Frank discussions under Chatham House rules, and listening valued as much as talking, and that was critical. Personally, I found the group incredibly effective. It enabled me, by listening to other people's experiences, to understand the frustrations that I faced were not unique to me or to my particular group. It enabled me to deepen my understanding of community engagement, to understand that it is far greater than simply carrying out consultations. So for me personally, I think without the support of the group, I'm not sure I would have continued with the project. But our aim was to produce something that wasn't simply a group that people could join, because that doesn't work in a geographical area the size of Wiltshire. So we've also created an online platform that has a range of resources around community engagement, video clips, papers, articles, discussion forum, and also within that, what we're calling the engagement network, which if you have access to it, there's a group of people who can be contacted by phone or email who will listen, who will ask questions, who will give advice and share experience, but they don't claim, and nor does the network, nor does the platform, to be experts. They don't claim to have all the answers. Their job is to listen, to question, to share, to help people to learn, reflect on that learning, and feel supported. Unfortunately, financial situation changed, and rolling that programme out to the rest of the operation boards was no longer appropriate or viable. But we think community engagement is a critical aspect of almost every community project and activity. And therefore, we have canvassed it around other community organisations in Wiltshire, and we've had a very, very positive response. It's an idea that has more work to be done on it, but we think it has a potential to provide support to community activities across the country, and we're very keen to take it forward. I started by saying that as a community leader, it can be both lonely and challenging. But the reality of the situation is that statutory authorities, as cuts continue to come, will have to depend more and more on volunteers and voluntary community leaders to improve and develop their communities. That requires the collaboration that Steve talked about, and collaboration is based on trust. And it's very important that all statutory authorities, not just councils, understand the pressures their community leaders face, are prepared to listen to what they have to say, respect what they have to say, listen genuinely, even if they're things that don't fit their preconceptions about a community and aren't things they want to hear. Because I have a real worry there needs to be more volunteering, there needs to be more community leaders who are volunteers, but unless the trust is established, I'm not sure that collaboration can happen. And I think that is a potential obstacle to the future of localism. Thank you.
Thank you, Colin.
Colin, there was one thing you said that I just was intrigued by. You said that one of the things you'd learnt was that community engagement was about a lot more than consultation. In less than a minute, can you elaborate on what you meant? What is it then that it is particularly more than just consultation?
Well, I think it's easy to think that you go out and give people questionnaires and you've consulted with them, that means you've actually committed them to the project that you're doing. And the reality is, once you've made them aware something has happened, you've got to continue to communicate with them. You've got to bring them into the project so they identify with it, they feel part of it, they develop some kind of ownership. It's no good us consulting in 2013 about a facility that may not exist until 2018 if we don't do anything else after the consultation, because people will forget that it's happening.
Right. Great. Thank you. Okay, David.
Thank you. I'm charged with talking about public services in this regard, and I just wanted to share a story which I heard last week, and I know people on platforms always say they heard something last week, but actually I really did hear it last week.
But from one of your constituents. That's what politicians say.
Suppose I go up and down the country. Yes. No, I don't. But I had to be quite careful about this story, because I've got to be careful not to identify anybody involved. But a year ago, you may remember in the press, there was some research published about one particular area, about accidents and emergency and the people who attended it, and the number of people who'd attended it in this same area more than 10 times a year. And there was one person who'd been nearly 200 times in a year. It's very interesting, the research, which didn't then identify any of the reasons for it, but I since met the person who had done the research, and they'd gone into it more deeply, and they'd found that one assumes, generally speaking, that these people are generally old, have a lot of medical problems. Actually, they're overwhelmingly young women, and who've got into the habit of feeling when they're down and vulnerable, which is often many times a week, to dial 999. They find that the ambulance picks them up, they get a lot of attention, get all these different tests. They're round mixing with people they trust, they feel better and they go home, and so the cycle goes round. It's a hugely expensive phenomenon. I was very interested in that. But last week I heard about a very similar story, and I can't say where this is, but it was somebody else who'd attended A&E more than 100 times. But there was a project there locally run by the ambulance service to identify these people, to find out what was really necessary. and they had identified this particular person, they'd worked with them, and the solution had been to buy them a cat. It's very interesting, that, because I think that that speaks to people shape localism in the sense that you cannot possibly write a Whitehall manual about what sort of pets one should give to people. That's something that only could be done in a relationship that's face-to-face, and if that requires a local institution. And I think there are a number of lessons from that story, I think. One is that the vast amount of money that is wasted currently in public service, I know that's not a fashionable view, but because we no longer have we don't have systems that can intervene on an individual basis or intervene, we don't have a system that has the wit to think, all of these people really need when they're not actually, they're bouncing around the system creating costs. You need something locally to do that. You need something flexible. You need something human scale. What I also think it says is that people need relationships, even if it's relationships with animals. And they are, generally speaking, transformed often by a relationship which allows them to give back in some way. And I think that's the foundation for a co-production relationship at local level with public services that really works. It's much more effective and more widespread than the need to consult. I think consultation is very important. You do need to consult. But in the end, people want to give something. Not everybody, but enough people to make a huge difference to public services if we have the local institutions that are able to do that. So there are various issues that I think arise from that. And one, of course, is the issue of scale and where it's effective to do these kind of things. And I think overwhelmingly it has to be local. But then you have these other problems, which we have at the moment, like do the savings from that sort of interventions fall in the place where the investment is? At the moment, they don't. How do you organise an institution that can act informally when that's what is required, when you're funding it nationally? I mean, there's recently been an agreement between the Time Banks movement and the DWP so that people, when they sign on, are directed to their local time bank. It's a disaster in many ways. Because, of course, it would be great to have people go into their local time bank to find they have a role to play. If more than 10 people do that in every job centre, it'll overwhelm the system. And really what you don't want is to end up with the DWP funding that informal, otherwise informal network, which will become something completely different. And yes, of course, if you fund it through the voluntary sector, you'll find they're in some terrible 3-year cycle of grant getting, and which requires them to screw everything up every 3 years and come up with some exactly the same thing and dress it up in a whole new language, pretend it's innovative, and to have a great gap in between, which doesn't work either. So there's a real problem there. But what I do think very strongly is that, two things. One is that it needs to be local if you're going to do any of those things, to find any of those sort of solutions. But that isn't enough. And that if you simply devolve power and do things the same old way, to do it as if on the end of an IT system, and to think that you have the flexibility then to deliver the services that people need in a human scale way, then you will also create exactly the same problems you have when you're doing it nationally.
Thank you.
I'm interested in, is your sense that this is an argument, David, that's being won? I mean, if you look at Simon Stevens' plan for the NHS, there's a lot of emphasis on partnership with people. We're doing a project with NHS England on the idea of health as a social movement. Mm. So do you think the idea of working much more closely with citizens, with the idea of seeing public services as the outcome of a relationship rather than the thing that is delivered, do you think this is an argument that's gaining ground, losing ground, or does it just kind of cycle around the system?
I wish I knew the answer to that. I think it's gaining ground, but if it is gaining ground, it's just gaining ground very slowly, because the other side is also gaining ground. I mean, there is a very powerful lobby that really believes that you can provide these things as industrial systems. And I think the lesson which I think the cat story makes is that when you do that, you find that people who don't fit in automatically with the bits on your IT screen then bounce around the system creating costs. And that's one of the reasons that public services are so expensive to provide and so ineffective. And that terrifying combination is one of the reasons we're in the situation we are now. So, no, I don't think we're quite winning yet. We're not losing either, but we're not quite winning.
Jackie McKinney, over to you.
Thank you. I feel like after you've had a very people-centric conversation, I'm now going to drag you back to bureaucracy, because I'm going to give you my thoughts on the government's approach to devolution up to now and actually get on to governance, which, if you can bear with me for 5 minutes, we'll get back to people, I think, after that. I think our view is that big changes in society, such as technology and how public services are delivered, should automatically lead us to think about how we engage with the public. And I think we are in danger of getting into a bit of space where we rely on a diktat from above or expect this to happen organically. And our view at the Centre for Public Scrutiny is that it's a basic principle, really. Decisions are better made when they involve others. And the best leaders, the best places, the best organisations get that. They get that the answers are in communities, they're not in committee rooms, they're not, you know, in their office blocks. And I think we've all seen the very tragic consequences where organisational hierarchy doesn't allow that kind of openness and, you know, transparency. So for us, devolution feels like a catalyst. It feels like a real generational opportunity to now look at the systems that we've created and try and correct them. And also, you know, we have to, because we can't afford to carry on operating in the way that we are. And I think this need to engage society capital, engage people out there, if we don't do it in the next 5 to 10 years, I think we will absolutely never crack it. And Matthew said, you know, we've been impressed and slightly terrified by the speed the government has operated. It's a bit like when the NHS moves fast, you think, oh God, I must be really sick. And I think, you know, if the government has moved as fast as it has around devolution, it is a good thing. And a lot of conversations we're having with the local authorities, be careful what you wish for. You know, this is what we've asked for a very long time. But I think our issue with the process so far has been around the lack of transparency and openness. It really has felt like proverbial smoke-filled rooms with men of a certain age having secret meetings with Whitehall officials and ministers, you know, with a handful of other people knowing what's going on. And I think for us it's the fear that that sets a precedent for how devolution will work in the future. And really there has been no engagement. You know, and no engagement even of the politicians who operate in that area outside of leaders, never mind the community and public groups outside of that. So we're trying to ask for more engagement, more transparency, because the only way these new arrangements will work is with that. Our other kind of risk that we've identified is the opportunity that people are being given is really going to be overwhelmed and swamped by the size of the agenda that they've signed up to deliver. And also the new partnerships that are being created are big groups of organisations to try and navigate through. So, you know, I've worked with enough councillors, and I'm sure there may be some in the room. You know, it's a difficult group of people to navigate through some changes, and all of a sudden we're asking them to take on powers, let go of powers. And our fear is that this leaves very little time and very little capacity just to think through how this new governance system may be redesigned in order to help them deliver, but also start to think about how do you use this to engage. And there's a real risk, I think, that we add another layer, more complexity, and this distance between the public and those that are governing them becomes bigger and bigger. And we know that some bits of the system work well, so I don't think that this is about throwing the baby out with the bathwater. The role of the local councillor is one, I think, can evolve and probably does need to evolve, but their role as community leaders and scrutineers is one that will serve us well and I think could continue to act as this bridge between local communities. And there are some great examples. I mean, Camden Council and their scrutiny function have recently done a project around the Bangladeshi community, which are 69% more likely to have a general long-term illness, 22% more likely to have a mental health problem. They went out and spoke to them. 300 people could go back and be their voice, put forward very practical examples. And these weren't examples which were, I don't know, build a new swimming pool or park. It was, we want to look after our own health, and this is what gets in the way. So I think there are some good ways, but also there are parts of the system that don't work well. You know, we've built these institutional organisations around our views of how services are delivered, and that doesn't match people's experience when their mum has a fall, for example. You know, it just creates these barriers that are impenetrable to people. So do we think the new arrangements will raise the bar? The Devolution Act includes you must have a scrutiny committee. instinctively that feels like the right thing. We actually told the government we don't think that's the right thing, because the danger is that people create a scrutiny committee and think they've cracked governance and involvement. So what we are saying is at least ask people to create governance frameworks. So the combined authority areas, and we're working with five of them, our ask is that you create a governance framework, gives enough of a push to local areas to actually think about how they're going to involve non-executives, think about how they're going to involve the public, but leave enough freedom and flexibility for what that might look like, and really encourage creativity, radical thinking, bespoke models, because I think what won't work is taking a local government model and expecting that to expand into local government plus. I think we need to be looking for a new and better model that includes a much broader church of public services, local organisations, real people, and actually start to think about how we can do that. But I think there are some real risks there around people's ability. But I think the main thing, which hopefully does chime with my colleagues, is that no system or structures will work if you don't have the right culture. And if going back to my original point, if you don't have that right mindset and mentality to see involvement as a positive and vital and valued and not as a bureaucratic delay, then I think we will fall at the first hurdle.
Thank you, John.
Jackie, I mean, I know because I've seen the research, although I can't remember the precise figures, but in county areas with districts, when you ask the public who's responsible for what, the public are blissfully unclear about this. Combined authorities will replicate that kind of two-tier structure across the whole country. Does it matter that if you live in Coventry, you're not quite clear whether the decision is the responsibility of Coventry or the new West Midlands Combined Authority? Or if you live in one of these areas where counties are coming together, you could live in a district and in a county. I mean, it's potentially, in some of these areas, five tiers of governance. Does that matter? Should legibility be an aim that we should have more for the system?
I think legibility doesn't matter. Absolutely, you know, I think it doesn't matter at all. However, I think accountability does, and I think there is a risk that you lose accountability within the system. And this is a risk that local authorities are managing now. More and more services are outsourced, delivered different ways. But I think the real issue, and I think we could, if Manchester carries through and the NHS lets go a bit, we could be in a situation where we have a hospital closure and who do people talk to about it? Is it going to be the mayor? Is it going to be the local councillor? Is it going to be Simon Stevens? Is it going to be the minister? Is it going to be... And I think there just will... If we want people to engage, they just need to have some level of understanding. And I think there's just this risk that if it feels too messy and too complicated, that they won't get over that next hurdle, which is, I care about my local school. I'd quite like to complain about it. Oh, it's an academy. Who do I... So I think there's just those sorts of risks. It's not essential, and we're never going to educate people because they're busy, but...
Great. Thank you very much for that. Katie Ghost, as I said, is Chief Executive of the Electoral Reform Society. Katie, what we've heard, I'll summarise for you.
Great.
Colin
well
talked about community engagement boards, the challenge of community engagement, that it's a lot more than consultation about the kind of support that is needed and is valued in that role. David talked about the kind of ideal of highly localised public services which are relational and personal, and the amount of money that is lost and wasted and pain that is caused by services that feel impersonal, which aren't just, as I say, they're not just tough to deal with, those services, but actually they're very ineffective. And you heard what Jackie was saying about issues of governance, welcoming many of the steps that have been taken towards devolution, but calling for a greater attention to governance and to accountability in that system. Have I done okay?
Very good.
Thank you. I do listen. I do listen. Yeah. Sometimes people think I've just got to go to sleep sitting in here, but I know I'm listening very good. Now, Katie, over to you.
Okay, great. Thank you so much. Fantastic to be here. I think what I'm going to say is going to follow on really neatly. There is a democratic deficit surrounding the march of English devolution, and I think that is well established now. There's been a lack of democratic consideration to the sort of process by which the deals have been developed. I don't think they've been grounded in, or the starting point hasn't been the kind of the principles or the values of people in a local area and then kind of coming up with structures based on that. But I also think there's been a real lack of consideration to the democratic substance of the new arrangements. So, for example, are we thinking about if a voting system that tends to produce one-party dominated local governments and weak oppositions in a lot of areas, a lack of scrutiny, is that right if you're going to have a lot more powers held in local levels? Is anyone going to vote for a regional mayor if it's been kind of given to you? Here's some more democracy, take it. So these are really important questions as well. So I think there is a democratic deficit at the moment. The question is, what can we all do about that? And I just want to spend a couple of minutes talking about a practical initiative called Democracy Matters that the Electoral Reform Society and many others have been involved with. And this was just a kind of a test run, really. It comprised of two deliberative assemblies, one in the Sheffield area, one in the Southampton area. And I think they've been a good example of just how deeply a representative sample of citizens will deliberate on the big questions of where power lies locally. And I think suggests they could be a kind of a forum or a model for a wide range of other topics and areas, another way of doing things. So where did the project come from? Well, in the aftermath, the immediate aftermath of the Scottish referendum, the Electoral Reform Society and many others began to campaign for a constitutional convention. And this was based on a really fundamental idea that if we're going to be looking at big questions of territory and power, these can and only should be settled with the fullest involvement of citizens and of people. And it felt like there were a lot of kind of closed doors initiatives, not least the Smith Commission, which kind of, there was incredible sort of breadth and depth of involvement of the Scottish people in the referendum. And then the next stages went very much kind of behind closed doors. So it was really a kind of response to that. The question very quickly came up, what is a constitutional convention? And it really felt that we needed to do a sort of a show and tell, a little bit of a sort of a mini convention. People were like, what is it? Is it just a glorified focus group? What's different about a convention from other ways of sort of getting people together? So with several universities in the ERS, we thought, okay, we're just going to give it a go. We're going to do a bit of a kind of a test run. And I guess another bit of the context was there are so many, I'm sure you've heard about some of them this evening, there's sort of lots and lots of experimentation in democratic involvement going on all over the place at the moment. So we had that at the same time as all the kind of constitutional cards have been thrown up in the air as well. So it's kind of quite an interesting convergence of two things happening. Of course, we then had the general election and a government without any sort of wish to have a UK-wide constitutional convention. So the game had moved on, but we did have this very live event of devolution deal, something very, very concrete and on the table for the citizens in our assemblies to get to grips with. So the simple aim, gather 45 broadly representative citizens together in two different parts of England. One would be a kind of a pure model, citizens only, and the other one would be two-thirds citizens and one-third elected representatives. That was the South model. And I was really struck with the RSA report that one of the themes that seems to be coming out of this is what can work well is the sort of the co-production. It's that the councils in partnership with citizens, it's tackling really difficult issues together rather than, you know, the council sets up a democratic means or a committee or something like that. So that was a real theme. And that was something I guess we were testing out as well, which is what happens when side by side people in an elected role and not in an elected role actually have to think through the issues and perhaps change their minds or change each other's minds even. So that was something a bit different we were trying to do. And the issue is, how do you want power? Where do you want power to lie? How do you want power to be organised in your local area? But very specifically, there were devo deals on the table in each area, so there was sort of something specific to be given as well. And the format was deliberative, and it was phased, you know, a bit of a learning phase. This is, you know, a chance to kind of learn about the complexities of the status quo and of local government, and then moving on to sort of taking evidence and hearing about the different options and sort of deliberation, and then some decision making about what they wanted to see. So it was very miniature because we only had two intensive weekends with the people who came, 3 weeks in between with a lot of Facebook interaction as well. Obviously, if you had a larger scale convention, you do it over a kind of a bigger amount of time. So I suppose what we were trying to do was to really get underneath the surface of what can actually happen when you do give people a bit more time and space and structure and knowledge and support? Is the level of the sort of discussion a bit different? And we also wanted to give people that chance out in the open a bit more, if you like, to say what they actually thought about the deals on the table, or if they might like kind of other models as well. So what happened? We found that the kind of strength and the depth of the engagement was very high once people were through the door. So, you know, pretty much 100% retention from one weekend to the next. But it's getting through the door, isn't it? So there are real issues around getting a representative sample. In some ways, we did well. In other ways, we really struggled with that. And I think that's a really big issue. And what do we mean by representativeness when we're talking about public and really deep sort of public involvement? The ability, and this is one of the things I feel really strongly about, because I'm often talking to groups of politicians, some of whom are absolutely passionate about public involvement, and some of whom, frankly, don't have much faith in their fellow citizens' ability to deliberate on complex constitutional matters. And actually, anyone who came to the assemblies will absolutely see, for real, everybody has an ability to deliberate on a complex constitutional matter if the people around them bother to give them the tools, the knowledge, the support, and if you have the time to do that. So it's been really, really good having a kind of a live example of that. And you really sort of see it. We saw people's kind of confidence, knowledge grow, the quieter people becoming more confident. So they've got quite a sort of transformational quality, I think. And also a lot of agility as well. So the assemblies were quite dynamic. So people, one of the assemblies, they said, actually, we don't want to talk. We need to talk about scale in our area. Yorkshire and Humber, we've got quite big. I just want to talk about scale. We don't want to talk about powers first. We want to talk about scale. Then we want to talk about the structure and the model. So I thought that was really kind of telling. Different ways of bringing politicians and citizens together. We're still doing a lot of the kind of analysis, so there's lots more to sort of reflect on. But I think I'd sum up by saying I think it did demonstrate people's ability to tackle a complex constitutional task in hand in a very pragmatic fashion. So even if people didn't like the deals, they said, we think the council should carry on fighting for something good. But they also really strongly said, we want kind of future involvement in this as well. That was a very sort of powerful message. So I think I'd probably just end by saying one of the big questions is that central government seems to have kind of outsourced responsibility for the democratic aspects of devolution to local councils. Local councils, for different reasons, are struggling then, it seems, in a bit of a straitjacket, tight timescales, conditional deals to kind of open the doors and let the public in. I think we know from our pilots that the answer to the question, who is able to deliberate in depth on complex questions of localism and power, citizens can. And I think that's what we need to take forward.
Thank you, Katie.
Katie, my question for you is this. I've seen so many bold and brave experiments in public engagement. You know, I worked at IPPR a few years after they'd held the first kind of proper citizens jury. We saw participatory budgetary. I mean, there's been wave after wave after wave of attempts to have imaginative forms of public engagement. They more or less all come to the same conclusion, which is precisely as you say, that it's hard to engage people in these things. Once you do engage them, actually, they're very interested about it. Their judgment is very good. You know, there's even kind of certain patterns of judgment which are consistent. One of the things one finds over and over again is that people kind of go into these processes thinking politicians are rubbish and the local authority is rubbish. And then when they're posed with the actual challenges, oh, it's harder than I thought. So it actually increases their kind of appreciation of the difficulty of the task of rulers. We know all of this, but yet, no, none of these experiments kind of catch fire, do they? Never become mainstream practice. You know, I suspect someone will be sitting here in 10 years' time and there'll be somebody else going, well, we tried this brand new thing, we did this and we did that, and it's working really great. How do we get it to the point at which this feels like just the way we do stuff?
One of the things we tried to do as part of the initiative was to bring the policymakers and the politicians into it. So all the time we were doing it, we were saying, look, this is what we're doing and you're part of it and learning. Because there's absolutely no point, it seems to me, doing the experiment and then after the event saying to the policymakers, look, that this did sort of work and this had value. So I suppose one of the things we've been trying to do with this is, you know, throughout it to get across the value. Because there is still a big gap, as I say, there is still scepticism, I guess, about the kind of value and the purpose of it. But no, I agree, there are kind of big issue. There's been a kind of quiet rise of deliberative democracy, and there are real issues now about kind of scale and, as you say, kind of making it normal and usual.
I've gone full of questions, but I've talked enough. We'll start here.
Okay, my name is Stephen Hill. I'm very, very involved in the community housing world, so Community Land Trust co-housing. I'll start with my question, which is very much about the democratic deficit. And how do you encourage elected politicians to recognise the legitimacy of democratic participation at a local level? And the kind of backdrop to that is really comes back to your comment at the beginning, Matthew, which was about the double devolution agenda. I was involved with Nick Rainsford's local government sounding board at the time. I think I was the kind of the token co-production person on the board. And trying to present on that, you know, the reaction would be, God save us from having to work with communities like that. Life's difficult enough already. And I probably shouldn't say who said that, but it is somebody who was very instrumental in local government. And there was very much a sense that this was just too much to contemplate. And so things like the community asset transfer agenda were seen as kind of a bit of a consolation prize. Aspects of the localism bill, I think, act as very similar. These are very circumscribed, slightly diversionary activity, not real levers on power. And yet what we're seeing as an example of community land trusts initially started as a way of very localised provision of affordable housing. But if you unpack that, that is local democracy saying we will suspend the way in which the market works and we give it legitimacy to do that because we all say we want to do it in this place. And what we're seeing now as it moves from the rural to the urban situation, seen it over the last year, people are saying there's a kind of a gap in local governance of kind of all the things that go together to make good placemaking. And if local government can't do it because it's so resourced, we will find a way of doing it ourselves. But there's still this, the gap is, can local authorities accept that this is, that people have the legitimacy to do this?
Thank you. I'm Sam Thomas. I work with a coalition of charities supporting people with very complex needs. And the examples about A&E are very familiar to the work that we're doing. And quite often the people that we're working with are those who end up repeatedly in A&E, in police stations, in the courts. So I can certainly recognise the opportunities of devolution. I suppose what concerns me is when I talk to local organisations, particularly voluntary sector organisations, in areas where there are devolution deals already, their understanding of how to engage with them is really pretty thin and often not for want of trying. And I think Katie and Jackie are quite right to point out the kind of the role of governance in that and the role of democratic scrutiny. But it strikes me that there also must be something that organisations could be doing to get out there and try and work out how they can use some of those levers. So I'd ask if the panel have a suggestion for, I suppose, a local community leader or a small charity. How would you make the most of a devolution deal in your city or in your area? What could you go out and do to get hold of some of that power and use it?
Good evening, my name's Andy. I'm a director of a charity called the Consortium of Therapeutic Communities. I'm also a psychiatric survivor. My question really follows on from the last gentleman's question. I campaigned about 10 years ago to save the therapeutic community in Sutton, and I got involved with the overview and scrutiny committees all over London around this. And cut a long story short, my question is really around stakeholderism. And how that can, it kind of jumps over the thing about tokenism, where years ago I was involved in things, they were very, very token. But it's become a lot more complex now. And I'm often in situations where I'm listened to quite attentively, and it feels like the voices of myself and my colleagues are being heard, but it's a bit of a mirage, really. And it feels like that stakeholder involvement I've been pulled into is legitimised through my involvement, but really the decisions have already been made, and it makes me quite cynical. And at some level, when you go out and give the message to other people to get involved, then they're involved in those processes and they become quite cynical. You go back to square one again, and it's something about how people can be involved at a grassroots level and retain that trust within each other when they're interfacing with these structures of power. And how you can challenge that kind of stakeholder, what would you call it, like the backdoor stuff being done. And you kind of sense it's being done, but you don't really know how to challenge it when you're there. It all seems to happen at the end where they say goodbye to you and shake your hand and thank you for your input and all that kind of stuff, but then ignore what you say.
Great. Thank you.
Here.
My name is Michael Lacoste. I'm suitably untitled. The essence of the problem I think we've been talking about tonight is the lack of universal transparency in decision-making. And if you can achieve that so that you've got public accountability with that, with a methodology, because nobody in this room, I don't think, has ever been trained to make decisions. It isn't a subject on any curriculum anywhere, unless you go for specialised decision trees, decision theories and what have you, which I've heard learned professors say even the people who are promoting it don't understand what they're doing half the time. But a methodology, which is a de facto methodology for decision making, which can be used by anybody for any decision, freely available on an internet, which has no vested interest whatsoever, i.e. it's beyond reproach, is what we need to make devolution work effectively, democracy to work effectively. Even public scrutiny would work much more effectively because you'd be able to see and understand how decisions have been made. Okay, you don't have to agree with them so long as you understand them.
Okay, thank you. So, panel, we've had a question about whether it's, as it were, local government really wants to empower people with particular relation to community land trusts. We had a question about how do any advice you've got about engaging with the new combined authorities. We've had a question about the phenomenon of stakeholderism, and then finally a suggestion that actually just much more profound transparency would help with a great deal of these problems. So, Colin, do you want to comment on any of that?
Yeah, stakeholderism. And I think there's a general theme coming out, this theme of a lack of trust. You don't feel that actually local authorities or statutory bodies actually really want to listen, really take account of what's said, make promises, and then they don't deliver. I think there has to be a change of culture. Now, one of the positive sides of the cuts might mean that change of culture has to happen because statutory bodies simply cannot do it on their own. And they have to find partners, and they won't get partners unless they treat those partners genuinely with respect.
I feel very strongly that engagement, important as it is not possible just like that. It has to be based on the trust which gets when you're doing stuff, not taking decisions, actually acting as a partner in the delivery of public services. And, you know, I don't think politicians get that, partly because they think, they think the highest form of life is sitting on a committee taking decisions. Actually, most people don't want to do that, but they do want to be involved. And at the last time I met Matthew, actually, we were both giving evidence in a famously tetchy meeting of the Public Administration Select Committee.
That was fun, wasn't it?
When he was brave enough to suggest that sort of co-production should apply to politicians, and there was a lot of sort of crossing of hands like this. And one of them said, well, I don't know what you mean. He said, my constituents are very grateful to me. And you realise in that, you know, this sense that, they want to sort of appear in a room and spread fairy dust and say, oh, yes, we're giving you all these things, and then they go away and enchant somebody else. And that's the life of a politician in their heads. Whereas actually, they've worked all their lives to be consulted and to sit on committees to everybody else. That's not what people want, really. It's not to say that it's not important, it is. But most people don't aspire to that, but they do aspire to be involved. And if you involve them, then I think the trust will be there for asking their opinions and getting them to solve problems for you later.
Very good. I sum that response up, David, with the wonderful phrase I heard a few years ago, which was public engagement is the hardest part of... The problem with public engagement is hard to reach groups, and there's no harder to reach group than politicians. So, Jackie, briefly.
OK, I think the how to break in question, we are dealing with people, and I think we can sometimes get caught up in the numbers of CCGs, the numbers of councils, the number of councillors, and I think it is about finding a person that you can build that relationship with and then badger them and keep badgering them and go round until you... Because I think we are getting to the point where we will have to let go. There is no choice about this. And as I say, if we don't, I think we are really going to have to think about how we manage public services in the future. So it sounds too simple, but I think that's the only way. I think on methodology, there is a science to this, and I spend a lot of my time and my team's time trying to teach people how to scrutinise, because I think there's a presumption you're a politician, therefore you ask effective questions, and it just doesn't happen. And I think it links to Katie. We will get more practised at this, and I think you know, we have to start to look at how we share the best practice and how we share those methodologies, because again, there's just this presumption there's this innate skill out there, and there isn't. And we've had a scrutiny system in place now for over 13 years, and it still doesn't work in certain areas. So I think the more that we can talk about this being, you know, having some kind of methodology and trying to share that best practice, but it's a difficult one.
Katie?
Yeah, I mean, I guess we're talking about meaningful public involvement that leads to actual hard changes in policy. So you're not just being persuasive, but you can actually see a sort of practical outcome. The question, I think, of how do you encourage politicians to accept legitimacy, I think the idea of a representative random sample of people being brought together to do deliberation and decision making is absolutely key, because you've often got forums where it is the same number of kind of self-selecting people, and I think that's just something that we need to get much better and practiced and kind of normalise. And I think that can be quite powerful for politicians who are a bit cynical sometimes about it being the usual suspects, if you have a genuinely representative random sample of the population.
Great. So the questions can last no more than a minute, and the answers can only last 30 seconds if we're going to finish on time, and I'm sure you can do it. So, yes.
My name's Tom Levitt. I'll speak quickly. I started my career 40 years ago in Wiltshire. I then had, after teaching in local government for 10 years, Member of Parliament, Labour MP for 13 years, half of which I chaired the Community Development Foundation. So that's my qualification. The CDF was a champion of localism, I like to think, in those times. I think, Matthew, that Labour did have only a superficial commitment to localism. I think the heartfelt historical view that provider knows best was never far away from the surface, and that's why it never really worked. Having said that, I think that the NHS personal budgets was a masterpiece and a real model to follow. And what people like Steve Reed did in Lambeth also, which was a devolution not just of responsibility but also of resources. I think the Tory approach to localism is that it chimes with their small government philosophy, and therefore localism to them is chucking services over the side and hoping someone will pick them up. And you can't devolve responsibilities without devolving the resources if it's going to work. And it's then what happens is what really worries me, and this is my question, which is why I'm speaking very quickly.
You do well, Tom.
And that is that areas of with high levels of social deprivation have the least levels of social capital, which enables them to operate in these areas. The big deprived communities have fewer voluntary sector organisations, counterintuitively, and much less enterprise going on, much less resources to call upon to help the community engage in positive ways and constructive ways to help sort of to influence the way things go on. And I don't think that a Wiltshire without Swindon really gives you enough experience of those big deprived communities in order to really come up with some answers about that. So I'd like the panel to say what they think about the challenges to deprived communities that this agenda faces.
Just saying, in fairness to the RSA, we did publish a major report a few weeks ago which was all around community engagement and social networks in the most deprived areas as well. So I know. Yes.
Hi, my name's Anna Lodge, and I'm a voluntary director of Totnes Community Development Society, and we are bringing forward a community right to build order project for a development called Atmos Totnes, and that's a different route to planning brought through the Localism Act, and one of the few organisations in the country using that. What we found there is that we don't present ourselves as directors, as leaders of the community. We're there to facilitate a community process, and critically that involves, and the RSA hopefully will be interested in this aspect, that they're actually professionals in that, so that professional engineers, designers and other elements. It's not just a dichotomy between community and statutory bodies, although that network is really important. One of the things I wanted to just draw attention to there is that facilitation model, to say actually if we facilitate a we model rather than an us and them model, you get a lot further, and we've had nearly 5,000 people out of an 8,000 population be involved in that process. And therefore my question really is how do we have a model which is facilitating and involves people trusting in a process rather than an outcome? And actually that's something for infrastructure organisations to really kind of grapple with. When you're not looking at an output, you're looking at a process, and you're inviting people to trust that process and follow it, ultimately in this case to a referendum on planning consent, but it's a model that could apply elsewhere. Thank you.
Fascinating. Thank you. And then finally, two incredibly brief comments down here at the front.
Hi, Olivia Darby from Wonder Foundation. Just building on this comment before about social capital, I think it's really interesting what you were saying about how people aren't stupid. They can make decisions when they have the tools and the knowledge. And I think a really important thing around that is also the cuts to ESOL, because obviously if people can't communicate with each other, they have huge barriers to that. And I guess I'd just like to know your thoughts a bit more.
And then in front of you.
I'm Jonathan. I work at the Education Endowment Foundation. And one of the things that we do is we conduct randomised control trials to find out what works in education. And I guess I want the panel's perspective of the challenge of when we have information on what works, allowing people to take power and situate that in their own context, but without losing sight of the actual key messages that we get from things like research.
Very good. My goodness, what a fascinating load of questions. And the panel have got 1 minute each to respond to the questions and leave you with a tantalising thought to take out into the cold of the evening. We'll go in reverse order. Katie.
Right, OK. So I guess the reason why the ERS campaigns for a complete modernisation and to kind of drag our democracy into the 21st century is that we feel so strongly about the need for this kind of democratic muscle building, which I think all the contributions have sort of touched on, and particularly your point about we. It's so old-fashioned when you look at your politics, the idea that you have the kind of elected representative there who sort of comes and gathers a few things and then kind of goes away again. None of this stuff works anymore, which is, I think, what we've really been kind of touching on. So the kind of facilitators, not leaders, the different styles of leadership and all that stuff, I think, needs a real kind of overhaul. And I guess that's what in a small way, we were trying to do with the assemblies as well, is have a kind of different and in-depth deliberative on an equal basis of elected representatives and people kind of coming together. So I guess I think that would be my response. And then I guess the thought to leave with, Jonathan, on your point, would be we've got this kind of massive political event of the EU political referendum coming up, and I think that's another kind of test bed for doing democracy in a different way. And instead of doing everyone down and saying nobody will be interested, why don't we kind of seize that as a massive political moment and do what you've suggested, look at what works, do some more kind of testing out and really think about that kind of question you've left us with.
Brilliant. Jackie.
I think the hope with devolution is that the focus up to now has been about economic growth. The good thing about the last round of devolution deals is that we have started to talk about well-being, we've started to talk about prevention, and I think, you know, the Manchester argument was based on the fact that we have put so much money into economic growth and we are still spending this much around welfare. So I hope that it just gives the local areas the freedom to start to have those we conversations and they don't get too caught up. And again, back to Manchester, you know, the leadership there has been asked the question, will it make a difference to the people on the ground? And they've said it won't work if it hasn't made a difference to the people on the ground. And I think we need to get that ethos there so that we start to see through. I think, you know, back to the question around accessibility and language and how we can get there, it is going to be one of the biggest challenges, I think, and it's been interesting that the Treasury has been leading the Devo deals, is that we are going to start to see this contradiction, I think, more and more around, is the government really dedicated enough to allow funding to go through in order to encourage people? And I think we're just going to start to get this big contradiction coming through. What do they keep hold of and what do they let go of? And I think that will be, you know, one of the challenges. I think the thought to leave people with, it is going in the right direction, but I think, interestingly, and we had a conversation this afternoon, we are now starting to talk about this more. It feels like devolution is starting to get noticed. Even my dad asked me, what's happening in Manchester about this Northern Powerhouse thing? You know, that's my dad. So it's starting to feel like we're having the conversations, and I think the more of these types of events and the more we're starting to talk up, the local areas will not be able to ignore your conversations and your requests. So I think that would be my
thank you
final thought.
David?
I think I've agreed with everything that anybody said, except possibly the one about devolving decisions to the internet. I'm not so sure about that. I may have misunderstood it. Don't let's go there now. But I'm still not quite on the same page as everybody else, I think, up here anyway, because I am sceptical of our ability to extend these ideas very far outside not into the mainstream, unless they're based on reciprocal relationships at the heart of public services, which is not about decision-making or consultation at all. They're about doing things. And I believe that when I went to community meetings in Great Barrington, Massachusetts, some years ago, where they were setting the budget, and I can tell you this, they bought a lot of snow ploughs on that basis. Every snow plough proposal was just went through on the nod, though they cut the police cars, I remember. I think that was the basis on the fact it was a highly effective, highly reciprocal community which really knew each other because they did stuff together, and I think that's the basis of everything else.
I do agree with that.
Thank you.
And then last but not least, Colin.
Okay. I'm currently working with deprived communities in Trowbridge who are similarly deprived to ones in Swindon, and you're right, but it is about identifying individuals, identifying social networks, working together, the kind of co-production that David's talking about, to do small things that improves their lives. It takes time, it's gradual, but it is the only way, and my thought is we have to keep challenging statutory authorities to work with the people they serve and listen to them.
Very good. So the RSA, we define our mission as power to create, and what we mean by that is that all our work really is around expanding the scope for human agency and creativity. So this debate goes to the heart of what we're concerned with. We've been delighted to do this project with Wiltshire. Paul, when's this report going to be available? Is it on the web now? Right now. So I'd encourage you to get the localism report that we're publishing today. There's an excellent report on a very innovative arts-based form of public engagement available outside, so take one of those with you. In the next few months, we're going to be unveiling a new citizen panel based upon the idea of how can we improve and open up economic debate. We felt that the economic debate at the last election reached depths never previously reached. So how can we enable ordinary folk to talk about economics in a way which engages people and to consider radical ideas? And we're involved in projects like the one I talked about earlier, exploring whether health, as it were, public health can be a social movement. So we will carry on with this debate, but tonight has been a really interesting example of that. Please stay involved in our work, and it just remains for me to ask you to thank our wonderful panel. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, why not download our free app to access video and audio files on the go? Just visit our website, therSA.org, and follow the links to the RSA Vision mobile app.